5
4
3 2
1
Well, hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Yes, another episode of the Technology Show. If you're blind or partially sighted, this is the place you come and you learn. Well, you don't learn very much, but you do get a lot of talk about technology. Sean Preece is my co-host and cohort. Hello.
Hello, Stephen Scott. That's a bold claim. I promise nothing.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said we should probably never say the show is an education. Although once someone did say to me, you know, I do think your show is a bit of an education. By the end of it, I thought, well, that taught me a lesson. quite a lot to get through. And Sean, you're speaking, well, we're both speaking, actually, to a guy who we're quite envious of this week.
That's right, a visually impaired YouTuber called James Rath. Now, he managed to snag the, let's say, the pinnacle of interviews with the top guy from tech. No, not Stephen Scott, it is Tim Cook.
I'm so jealous.
I know, we're actually interviewing the guy who interviewed Tim Cook. That's how jealous we are.
Yeah, that's all we do here is tenuous links. Tenuous links, and that's our new segment here. Also, I'm going to be speaking to Amy Bernal. She's from Aira, which is the company that is making a new spectacle device with a camera built in and an earphone. I'm going to tell you more about that later. All that coming up on this week's Tech Talk. So here we are once again, Sean and I, with no Julie this week. Julie's away. She's doing guide dog training at the moment with Coco the guide dog. Who comes up with these names, Sean, honestly?
I know, it does sound like a clown, but it's a cute name. You know, you can't get away from guide dogs having cute names.
Coco the clown dog. I like that. Yeah, shout that in the park. So Coco and Julie are off getting to know each other. It's a while before we'll see or hear from Julie, I think, because she's going to be quite busy with that. She has left us a few bits and pieces, though. She's like her mum. You know, she always leaves us sandwiches, and that's nice. So she's left us some bits and pieces to go through. We're going to be finding out from her over the next couple of weeks about the milestone Daisy player and recorder. Now, I don't know if you've ever used one of these, Sean. They're the weirdest little devices, but they're very effective and they're great for note-taking.
Yeah, now, I haven't heard of these before, but the description from Julie's audio, it sounds fantastic. Credit card sized. I'm quite interested, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a great thing. So we're going to hear about that in future episodes, but let's not tease too far because we've got lots to get through in this episode. But we want to start with your emails because, of course, we know you love sending emails through. Ruby has been in touch and she has said, guys, just to let you know if any other listeners have noted that on the recording for the last episode, that's 184, really the Prime Amazon Prime Video Paul Porter's audio content was repeated.
Uh-oh.
I think due to it being quite a short recording, it would have been hard to miss.
Uh-oh.
Did that happen, Sean?
I will admit it, yes, that was my fault. I did the edit on that and I just totally missed it. I will say, I find it so interesting, Paul Porter's piece, that I just wanted to hear it again.
Yeah. It was just so good, you wanted to hear it all over again. Now, it could be a small issue, says Ruby, that my file was downloaded onto the Apple podcast capture and it was corrupted and hopefully no one else was affected. Well, yes, everyone else was affected, Ruby, because it came to everybody. But yes, it has been rectified on the podcast. But yes, I mean, it was such a good piece of audio that we thought we may as well play it again. Or at least that's what Sean thought. I'm blaming him.
My bad. Sorry, Ruby. Sorry, everyone.
Blame on Sean. Right. Regarding the show, though, Ruby says, I've been waiting for Amazon Prime to have audio description for ages. I'm waiting the movie Gravity to be available. That is a great movie. I've only seen Gravity once. Didn't make much sense of it, to be honest. It needs AD. She says, awesome film. I've seen myself getting annoyed if a TV show or movie is not audio described to the extent that when my Sky recorder didn't download BBC London Doctor Who correctly, I watched the on-demand version on Sky and then synced my iPhone with the BBC iPlayer streaming the AD version through an earphone so I could still get some description. Wow.
That's dedication. That's hardcore. Streaming them up, syncing them together just to watch Doctor Who.
Yeah, I might like Doctor Who. I don't, but I might like Doctor Who. And, you know, I would want to watch it, but would I go that far? I'm not so sure, but I think it does highlight how sometimes we have to go that bit further if we really want to see something. It just highlights the lack of availability of audio description on demand. But, you know, you and I talked about this. There is now a law going through government that will actually change that. And hopefully, in the next couple of years, we'll start seeing some benefits to that law. Hopefully, anyway.
No, I think it just shows how important AD is to us. You know, we just, if it hasn't got AD, we're not interested.
Absolutely. Listen, thanks for that, Ruby. Thanks for your email. Richard's been in touch, who says, recently I subscribed to Amazon Prime, giving me access to the Amazon Prime Video Library. I was delighted to hear that the other day that Prime Video are now offering audio description. However, I've been trying to watch some of the listed AD movies and cannot seem to activate the audio description. Do you know how I can access this audio description on Prime Video, or is it not yet available? Thanks. Well, the answer is it is available, but Sean, it seems, is the only person in the UK who's managed to get hold of any.
Well, look, it depends what platform we're talking about. I've only tried it on the iOS Amazon Video app, and when you're watching whatever program you're watching, double tap the screen to get the controls up and swipe until you hear the subtitles and audio button. Double tap on that, and you should find in a list of audio streams, audio description. That's how to do it on the iOS app. Now, Amazon Fire TV stick, on the other hand, that's down to Stephen.
Well, good luck with that, because you know mine just doesn't do it. So this is the thing. I don't know if it's there or not. That's the honest truth. And I've been asked this by a few people on Voreal this week, which is an app that you can sign up to if you're blind or partially sighted. Loads of blind people are on there asking questions of each other. Some of them we wouldn't necessarily go along with. But yeah, Voreal's, it's a social network. You know, you're going to get stuff on it that's not going to be savoury. The Amazon Fire Stick, to be honest, it's very difficult to know, because the accessibility, the voice view software that's built in now to the Amazon Fire Stick, which has been updated with the new version with Alexa, that actually lets you access the whole system with this voice view, so you can use audio to get around the screen. The problem is, when you start watching a program, what I would usually do is I'd start the program, pause it, and then find the audio and subtitles menu, and then enable audio description. But I can't find the menu that actually does that, because when you press pause, there's no way of navigating around the screen. It just sort of bonks its way, as I call it, through, which is bonk, 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 bonk. Yeah, that's all it does. It just goes bonk, bonk every time you press it. So it means it's not finding anything up, down, left, or right. That's quite frustrating. That's something Amazon really need to sort out.
Well, like Amazon said, this is a rollout. So, you know, depending on the platform, I'm assuming they're going to be working on that, get a voice view working with the controls on the screen. But until then, maybe there's another workaround, if any of our listeners know. You know, like on the Apple TV, before the fourth gen, you had to hold down like the play button to get a audio description menu up on Netflix. Maybe there's some workaround there. I have ordered one, because I'm going to get back into the Amazon Fire TV stick. Now they've got AD, so I will find out if I can find it, and if I can find anything, I will do a piece for next week.
Yeah, that would be good. And also what I would say to you is that I think you're going to love the Amazon Fire Stick. I mean, it's got problems. It's not perfect. You know, not every app is accessible. Apple TV is just bang on with that. I mean, that's just the truth of it. You know, for accessible television, pretty much Apple TV's got it in the bag. The issue with Apple TV is you don't have a lot of choice when it comes to players. You've got Netflix, you've got iPlayer, and that's kind of it, really.
Yeah, it's really lacking for the UK stuff specifically, ITV,
really
Channel
lacking.
5, Channel 4, and I have no idea why they wouldn't jump on that platform, but they don't.
I have no idea. I have no idea why ITV aren't on there, Channel 4. I mean, you think with BBC being on there, you can understand if BBC weren't and it was just Netflix, you could almost understand it. But the fact that the other ones aren't there and BBC is bizarre to me. Surely it isn't that difficult to write an app. They're writing apps for every single platform you can think of. I mean, they'll be writing apps for your Samsung smart fridge in about 5 minutes, you know? And I can't get it on Apple TV. It's ridiculous. Okay, well, thank you for that email, Richard. Michael's also been in touch. He says, hi, folks. I recently signed up to Tech Talk. Hang on a minute. Can people sign up? Is there money in this, Sean?
I haven't received any.
Oh, right. We'll need to check that out.
Is there a Tech Talk fan club?
Well, I think...
Just me, a member.
I think we're in it, yeah. I think this is it. I think what he means is he signed up to the podcast. He says, I thought I would enter into the discussion regarding operating systems. Now, he says, I've used an iPhone for over 4 years, and I would suggest that as far as accessibility is concerned, iOS probably just shaves it. I suggest this because of the feel and interactivity of it. Also, it should be noted that it is possible for a totally blind person to set up an Apple device out of the box without sighted help if one has the experience. As of yet, I am not aware it is possible to activate TalkBack on a new device without help from a third party, although I am happy to stand corrected. I think the answer to that is you can with TalkBack, can't you, Sean? You can start up TalkBack on an Android device.
You can, yeah. But the thing with Android is, we've said this many times, it's not just the amount of different devices that are out there, it's the amount of different versions of Android. So on the later versions of Android, turn on your device and hold two fingers towards the center of the screen. Just hold them down there and eventually TalkBack will start up. So it is accessible out of the box. Now, for the steps after that, for the initial setup, I'm not too sure. I will say you need to sign into your Google account. And to do that, make sure you've got some headphones handy, because when you're typing in your password, it will not speak out the letters that you're typing on the keyboard. For security reasons, it's actually a really good feature. You need to plug in your headphones and then it will speak whatever you're typing, so you can actually type. So that, from that aspect, it is accessible out of the box. But the point is, if you're running that version of Android, if you're running an earlier one, some of the earlier ones you had to draw a rectangle around the screen to start TalkBack, and it was a terrible idea. It just didn't work very well. Yeah, the later versions, absolutely easy to set up out of the box. Well, I say easy. That I'm not sure, but you can do it yourself out of the box.
There's a big difference between accessibility and usability, isn't there?
That's exactly right. And that's a point Michael made there about the feel of an OS. I think that's an excellent point. You know, if you're swiping and it's consistent, you know, you're swiping to the next item and it feels smooth and responsive and it just feels like it should. It's hard, really hard to explain the feeling of it, but it just feels right. And there's a phrase that I use a lot, which is clunky. You know, something's accessible, but it's clunky. It just doesn't feel nice to use.
Well, Michael goes on to say in his email that, in my opinion, iOS was marginally better for accessibility reasons, though Apple should not be complacent, he says. About a year ago, I treated myself to an HTC 109, a stock Android product. That means that it came with the original Android software. Some versions, and what he's referring to, Michael, in his email, is that some manufacturers, Samsung, one of them, will sort of make their own version out of Android. I mean, it's the same software at the core of it, but, you know, they sort of add their own bits and bells and whistles to it, whereas the stock Android products are just, you know, it's almost like out the factory, if you like. Michael goes on to say, I discovered that some apps seem to be more accessible using the Android version running TalkBack as opposed to iOS with VoiceOver. For example, ITV Hub, which carries audio description, but on the iOS devices don't. That's really annoying. Also, one of the most significant examples of Android being more effective is Travelline GB. On a number of occasions, I've had to catch buses on slightly unfamiliar routes. With the iOS version, if I search for a particular route, as I swipe through the list of stops, VoiceOver will just recite button, button, button.
No.
I know. When using the Android version, the TalkBack speaks out a clear label as to the stops I'm passing as I swipe, making it easier to plan my alighting stop. Basically, what this means is you can turn your device into a talking bus, speaking out the stops as you travel. He says, I should point out that you have to set this feature in operation every time you need it. Don't just jump on a bus, launch the app, and expect it to happen automatically. It won't. Setting up tracking or stop alerts is a feature that will probably lend itself more effectively with some kind of demonstration, and Michael is offering to do that for us. So we thank you for that, Michael, and we thank you for your email.
I'd be really interested in that. That sounds really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a quick note, and this one's to our listeners, because Sean and I will have no idea to this one. I'm happy to admit that. Dear Steve, first of all, I want to say a big thank you to you, Sean and Julie, for presenting such a good programme.
Oh, thank you.
I'm wondering if anyone else has experienced the same as I have. I've recently upgraded my computer to Windows 10 Creator at the end of May, and prior to that I had no problems in downloading and transferring Audible books from my computer to my Victor Reader Stream, the first edition. I am also lucky to have the later version of the stream, which has Wi-Fi. I tried to transfer a book this week onto my original stream, and when I plugged it in, it said it was connected, but then it kept making a noise in the computer and saying it was not connected. I contacted Humanware, who said it maybe my long cable was faulty, so I purchased a new one, but had the same problem. I've contacted HumanWare again, and they've gone into the computer via remote control, and it appears the computer does not seem to recognise my stream. If I connect to the later version of the stream, which has Wi-Fi in it, I have no problems at all. Obviously, Microsoft must have done something in their latest upgrade to stop me using the stream. Have you or anyone else had any ideas or contact with anyone from Microsoft or heard of this problem with the latest upgrade not working with different equipment? Many thanks for your help. And that comes from Narina, who is sending this message about Windows 10 Creator Edition and using it with her first edition Victor Reader Stream. That one goes out to the audience because I must admit I don't have a Victor Reader Stream. If Julie was here, she might know the answer to that, but certainly we don't.
No, I don't have one either, and I haven't heard of this problem, but we will definitely look into it and see if any of our listeners know, or we will look into it and find out for next week.
Yeah, well, if you know, get in touch, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We'll all help each other out one way or the other. Thank you for your emails. We didn't get to them all, but we will get to... If you've sent in an email and you're thinking, oh, he hasn't read it out, what's wrong with him? Well, there's lots of things wrong with me. But what I'd say to you is we will get to your email over the next couple of weeks. We're very excited this week because we're talking to a guy who's talked to a guy we want to talk to. Sean, tell us more.
Well, exactly. It's like one degree of separation. James Rath, a visually impaired YouTuber, he's managed to get the interview that everyone wants, and we think it's fantastic. Joining us now, James.
Thanks for having me.
First things first, before we talk about the thing that we really want to talk to you about, that everyone else will be intrigued to hear about as well, let's talk about you. Because you're a YouTuber, aren't you? You make YouTube videos and I guess you blog and vlog and all that stuff?
Correct, yeah.
So tell us a bit about it. How did you get into it?
I mean, I think I just kind of woke or grew up at the right time that YouTube was emerging. I mean, I didn't really find my niche until more recent, but I've been on the platform since 2006. I was about 10 years old, and I've always been intrigued by making movies, video creation. And the thing that really sparked that was the fact that when I looked through a viewfinder, I could really see. I could see from a distance for the first time because I have albinism and nystagmus, which is non-correctable. So yeah, cameras just really intrigued me as more than just a medium or a tool to create, but as an assistive technology. And that's what kind of got me into video creation today.
That's really interesting because... because I've got nystagmus as well. We match. And I've also got optic nerve hyperplasia, which means basically the optic nerve is damaged and has been since birth. So, you know, I get what you're talking about because I was into making movies for a long time and making little films and stuff. And a lot of people used to question why I would ever get into it because they'd say, well, why? You can't see what you're doing. But you're right. When you've got that viewfinder up at your face or you've got that little screen, you can see much more of the world, much more close up than you can in the real world. It's bizarre, but it kind of works.
Absolutely. And I think people always don't realize that there's a spectrum of blindness.
Yeah.
It's always just an on-off switch and there's nothing in between when that is very, very inaccurate.
Very inaccurate, yeah.
No, absolutely. I do the same thing as well. If I drop something on the floor, I tend to get my phone and put the camera on because it's just something about the higher contrast and it's something that's really hard to explain. Like you say, you know, trying to explain what you can actually see, what your vision's like, it's virtually impossible.
So let's ask the obvious question then. What can you see?
So my vision, it's about... on average, 2300 of the acuity. Basically, the way I see, I have videos that kind of emulate my vision. One is called 20 Years of Continuous Vertigo, and it's a short film where people can kind of see what it's like to view through my vision in like first person. Really, what that video focused on was the nystagmus part. I recently created another short film back in February called Looking on the Brighter Side, and it's a movie about albinism. So what I do see is constantly things are never in focus. Things are constantly like, if I start focusing on something, it really starts moving. Though it's not really moving, it's just my eyes trying to dance, basically.
Yeah, I get that.
I also have photophobia. My eyes can be very sensitive to light, And so oftentimes I'm wearing sunglasses, whether that's indoors or at night or outside during the day. The albinism itself just kind of has some blurriness. So those are kind of the three layers where you have the vertigo, blurriness, the photophobia, and just the albinism's lack of vision. And it creates this unique vision. I mean, I'm still lucky I can see color and I can see shapes to an extent, but lack of details there unless I really zoom up. But technology's great.
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, you know, you make the videos, you make the YouTube channel, and, you know, you mentioned the videos, which, by the way, is a brilliant way of plugging the channel. Well done on
Thank
that
you.
One. But on that point, you know, there is a video on there which a lot of people around the world were very interested in watching, and that was the time you met Tim Cook. You lucky person. How did you manage to get an interview with Tim Cook when I've been trying for 5 years to get him on this program?
So we'll back up a little bit. A little over a year ago, I made a movie called How Apple Saved My Life. That movie came about because I was just trying to create a video about accessible technology, and I was just trying to find all the accessible tech, the things that I don't have a hassle using, and I realized all those products around me were Apple products. So then I really thought about it, and I realized like how much these have really impacted my life. So what happened was I decided to just kind of tell a little bit. I mean, I've done it in parts where I've told a bit of my life story, but in different areas, you know, the mental health area I focused on in one video, the school area in another video, but this one I really focused on school with a little bit of the mental health portion of my life, and specifically how technology impacted that, and the independence and the really the hope that tech gave me. And it all happened to be Apple technology, how it allowed me to pursue video with the fact that I can edit my own videos but be zoomed in like 500 times into the screen, something that I couldn't really do growing up working on like Windows Movie Maker or Sony Vegas on Windows, because it's just at the time when I was using Windows, the magnifier either was very, very limited or didn't exist. I can't remember. But basically that film then sparked, I guess Apple saw it, and Tim Cook ended up tweeting out that video about 4 days later. So then that video even caught on further with like the Huffington Post, CNN, and so from there moving forward, Apple, I guess I was just on their radar. They were aware of who I am. And then kind of fast forward to about a year later, Apple's kind of been a big supporter of GAD, Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And this year it was like a week-long event on their campus where they had all kinds of interesting and exciting events. Some I can talk about, some I probably can't, but...
Go on.
Yeah, come on. Tell us all. When are they bringing out a car?
I got to share a good portion of the trip in another video, actually, that came out shortly after the Tim Cook video, which is called Visiting Apple's Headquarter Campus. Kind of a neat thing. We get to see a little bit more behind the scenes of what it's like visiting Apple that most people don't get to see. While I was there... Yes, they ended up allowing me to interview Tim Cook, the CEO, and we had a nice conversation over coffee about the importance of accessibility and Apple's current stance on what accessibility means to them. And I think overall it was a great discussion and something that a lot of people need to hear.
Wow. So when you went there, did you know you were going to interview Tim Cook?
Not really. Well, it was kind of a last-minute thing that was arranged. He's a busy guy, but I'm glad he made an hour of time to chat with me and some others in the community. There's two other YouTubers who were with me as well. We all kind of did our own style. Mine was more, I think, of a traditional interview, if you will, kind of style. One was more of a fun discussional video, and the other one was a really neat video that kind of talked more about like fitness and music and...
I got to pick you up on saying you thought yours was more traditional. I just loved the way you introduced him, whereas you said, I've got this guy with me today. I'm going to let him introduce himself. It's like, oh, okay, it's just some Joe blogs. Hello, well, my name is Tim.
This guy called Tim.
That's Tim Cook.
Well, people have asked me about that, the way I introduced him. Some people thought it was a little like unprofessional. Some people thought it was kind of neat. The way my idea behind it was, well, I don't think I can do it justice, what this person does. And I also like to see how people do introduce themselves. You know, you can kind of tell a lot about a person. I'm not going to like really get into detail, but you can tell a lot about a person just from the way that they share who they are. And so by putting him on the spot like that, I think that's the best way to sort of set the tone for this interview.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it was great, and a great opportunity to sit down and pin him down and ask him questions on accessibility. Because, you know, when we see Tim, we generally see him standing on stage announcing new products, whatever it might be, but we very rarely hear him talk about accessibility and all the things that come with it. For you, getting a chance to visit the Apple campus and getting a chance to meet and interview Tim Cook must have been great. I wonder, though, what your thoughts are on the other side of the world, shall we say, the Android side of the world. Because, you know, there are people out there who will say, and we're listening to this with two fingers down their throat, saying, oh, here we go, more fanboy talk. And I get that, and we all get that to some degree. But, you know, you say Apple saved your life. Do you think anyone will ever make a video called Samsung Galaxy S8 saved my life?
I don't see why not. But I think really what it came down to was Apple had this ecosystem and these different products that I use for different things all talk to each other and communicate with each other better than I think anything else on the market. I got to use my iPhone in class. I was using that to scan papers, and then it would be shot right to my Mac, and my Mac would be able to use like Adobe Acrobat to take that PDF and suddenly scan it to have it read it to me. And creating those accessible PDFs in like less than a minute or two was pretty important for me to succeed in school, or at least pass in school, because it was a little late when I really discovered the Mac. I wish I had known it a little bit sooner. However, talking on the other side of things, like I have had Android in the past before I had an iPhone, but I find the accessibility to be more comfortable on iOS. People can disagree, and that's totally okay. People have their own preferences of the platforms. That's cool. So I think Google's been making great strides with accessibility as well. But I think the other thing is, when you have these manufacturers creating so many different devices, there becomes an inconsistency with what to expect on your device. What settings are there? What capabilities? You know, are the manufacturers manipulating any of the accessibility, or are they adding in their own? It can be a good thing and a bad thing, I guess. That's just sort of my perspective on it. If you're looking at an Android device, definitely play with the accessibility ahead of time. Do it with any device, really. But even if you think you're familiar with the operating system, again, it can be different on every device, new piece of hardware. So
it's always interesting to me, because we hear from so many different people who say to us, and we've had this conversation, Sean and I have been subject to this so many times, you know, you're Apple fanboys, you only ever talk about Apple and how wonderful Apple is and all that stuff. And, you know, that's our choice. We choose to use Apple, as you do. And that's just the choice we've made. I mean, we could easily switch tomorrow and say, do you know what, if, you know, Samsung or LG or whoever bring out the next big great phone and it happens to have amazing accessibility through Android in it, then I'll consider it, we'll think about it. When we hear about Apple fanboys, what we really mean is iPhone and iPad fanboys. We don't really mean Mac fanboys, because when it comes to the other side, you've got Microsoft, you've got Windows, and a lot of blind people using JAWS or NVDA and prefer using that. So, you know, this idea that, you know, if you're in Apple, you're all in with it, that's not actually the case, is it?
No, and I mean, people can have their own devices, you know, for different things. I totally don't think you should limit yourself. I use Mac. I mean, for one, yes, it's accessible out of the box, and everything I need it to do, it does already. I also have Final Cut Pro. Final Cut is what I use to edit my videos. It's a piece of software made by Apple for video editing, and that's what I'm most comfortable using for my workflow. It's the fastest, and so that's why I'm not over on Adobe right now. It's the whole package for me.
Like you just said there, I think it just depends whatever works for you. You know, it's good that we've actually got this choice now. We're not stuck with just Apple or Android or Mac or Windows. You know, you've got that choice. So if you find something that works for you, then stick with it. But I wanted to say, I think this is my opinion, but I think if it wasn't for Apple, I don't think we would have accessibility in the mainstream devices like we do now. So I think Apple definitely needs some recognition for that, if nothing else.
Absolutely. What I liked so much about the iPhone was the fact that when they introduced VoiceOver, which was on the 3GS and Zoom, it felt more inclusive, more like it's a device for everyone.
Yeah.
What that means is something that my mom and dad use, two people who are sighted, have never really, I felt like, have fully grasped my world. All of a sudden, they're using the same device that I'm using to see the world. And it really, I think, normalizes accessibility. It's kind of incredible how far we've kind of come. I mean, I could be walking around with a giant miniature CCTV or digital magnifier with me all day, but the fact that I can get that same similar features right on the iPhone, something that's much thinner and right in my pocket and has a really good camera for that size, I'm pretty content with how technology is really, in a way, it's normalizing disability or mainly accessibility at this point. That's the way I'm kind of seeing it right now.
I think that's a really good phrase, normalizing accessibility. I'm going to steal that one.
That's a new tag for the show. We've just decided that. Sorry,
it's really
James,
good.
We've just taken it. Yeah.
Sounds
but
good.
It does, you know, there is, I mean, you do feel sort of set apart, almost segregated anyway. And if you're carrying around technology that's the size of a wardrobe and specifically designed for you, you know, it even makes you feel even less involved. And like you say, once you're using the same technology, the same devices as everyone else, as your mum and dad or the rest of your family, you know, you suddenly, it's really hard to explain, but you just feel like you're part of it.
Yeah, no, you're right. And what I really, really like is, again, it's something that is just in my pocket and I'm ready to use it a different way, but I can still use it the same way as everyone else. And another thing you said, I think there was the fact that it's, again, it comes to your comfort level. It's all out of the box. Instead of something that is specifically designed for you, this giant clunky thing, this is still a device that was designed for me. That's what I like is, I think Apple's stance on accessibility is it's always there from the forefront. We saw it with the Apple Watch. When the Apple Watch launched, that thing had VoiceOver, Zoom, bold text, some hearing features as well. And so I think when Apple puts accessibility forward and it's a priority, that's what I like to see. And that's what I want to see more from these companies. Instead of it just being a firmware update that comes 6 months later, it's nice to have it out of the box. Of course, there's always going to be room for improvements and new features added. But once again, it's nice to see that a company wants their product to be used by as many people and all kinds of people right from the get-go.
Absolutely. On the point of your video work you do, what kind of cameras do you use? How do you do that? I mean, is there any sort of anything you do with the cameras to make them more accessible to you, or do you find that most of them generally just are?
So with cameras, that's a good question. I don't try to limit myself with any specific camera. I've been using, I own a cinema camera, something that's like $4,000, and it's nice, and I use it more for studio work, stuff that is going to be more cinematic, short film based. But at the same time, I own a couple of DSLRs, I own point and shoots, but my main driver that I've been using in my more recent videos is the iPhone. The iPhone, I think, has a pretty incredible camera, and I find it accessible to just carry around with me and use that as a camera, because it's simple to pull out. right from the lock screen. I always carry like a little grip with it, so it has a stabilizer. And yeah, that's sort of been my camera of choice as of late. I've used that for my more recent my Coachella video and my visiting Apple campus video. In fact, the Tim Cook video itself was actually shot on an iPhone.
It seems appropriate, doesn't it?
I was going to say, did Tim make you do that?
Yeah. What you should have pulled out your Samsung and said, right, hang on, I'll just set this up.
No, like even the fact that I did actually set up a point and shoot and like two DSLRs. The DSLR is stuck. You can tell that it was shot with two DSLRs from the close-up shots, but the wide angle, I just felt like the iPhone did the trick, so I stuck with it.
Yeah. No, it's great. It was a great video to watch, and you know, it's actually even more fascinating finding out how you do it, because I think a lot of people out there would be interested. I know it's something I enjoy doing. I'm sensing that you and I need to talk more on this topic, James. It's brilliant. So what you're basically saying to us is, I mean, Sean and I are keen to get Tim on, and if Tim happens to be listening to this interview, then, you know, he's more than welcome to come on the show, but I'm thinking that the only way to get his attention is for Sean and I to make some kind of movie together, which I think will be less like your kind of movie and more like some kind of, I don't know, Scooby-Doo or Thelma and Louise type farce.
Where did Thelma and Louise come from?
I don't know. I'm just thinking of two, Cagney and Lacey. I don't know. You know.
We'll work on it. We'll workshop this. Don't worry.
We'll put that in planning. Yeah, I think we need a storyboard and stuff. But yeah, it's great to hear you talk about what you do, James. For people who want to follow you and find out more, and I really encourage them to check out your YouTube channel, where can they find it?
They can youtube.com/JamesRath, and that's James and then R-A-T-H, drop that W, and you are set.
Thanks, James.
Cool, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Well, he seemed like a nice guy, Sean.
No, oh, he was, wasn't he? He's so laid back. It's so LA. I just felt so old. He was too cool for me.
Yeah, too cool for school, that guy. and, you know, clearly for me as well. Yeah, okay, well, let's move on because I want to talk to Amy Bernal. Amy is from a company called Aira. They've produced a pair of glasses with a camera built in and an earpiece as well. And the idea is that by using 4G or Wi-Fi technology, you can walk around with these glasses on and you can be constantly connected with someone in your ear, a live human being talking to you and helping you out. So if you're out shopping and you're looking for something, you want to read a label, your agent will be on hand. They'll be able to see what you're looking at. Sounds fantastic. Well, let's get Amy on. Amy Bernal is from Aira. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.
So, really interesting time because there's so much new tech coming out that relates to augmented reality or artificial intelligence and all of that stuff. And you're starting to get into that world as well with Aira. For those who don't know what it is, first of all, tell us about it.
Sure. So Aira is a service that allows our users to connect with an Aira agent, and they connect to that agent who is a real person who's trained and either working here at our office in San Diego, California, or working from home. We have agents spread throughout the United States. And our users essentially put on a pair of smart glasses, so glasses that have a video camera above the right eye. And they launch the Aira app on their phone and essentially make a request or a call. And that request is answered on the agent's computer on their smart dashboard. And it's kind of like a mission control style dashboard. And so when the agent accepts the user's call, they're able to see real time that live video stream and from the camera that is on the user's glasses. And they're also able to see where the user is located through a Google Maps integration. They have a street view access, and then they have much more data available to them, such as integration with Uber and other information providers that are local to the area. And they also have a rich profile about the user based on their preferences. So are they a cane user or a dog user? Do they have any dietary restrictions or preferences that they wanted the agent to be aware of? A lot of times we have users message our agents or send them information about the task on hand. So you can imagine when you land at an airport, the agent would have that map of the airport pulled up and prepared with which gate you are seeking to find. And then that agent would be able to not only give you directions to get you from the gate that you landed at to the gate that you are boarding the other plane or maybe even exiting the airport, but they're also able to tell you about all the restaurants or shops or amenities in the airport along the way. So essentially, our service is available right now from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We're open 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And right now, our agents accept our users' calls within 7 seconds. And our goal is to expand to be 24 hours a day, hopefully in the next couple of months. And we always want to keep that call answer time extremely low. It's obviously as close to a real-time answer as you can expect.
That is quite incredible. I mean, there's so much in there we could talk about. We could talk about this for days.
Yeah.
Because there is so much to this. I mean, we've seen apps along the way like Be My Eyes and apps like that, that try to help people do things. But it's often led by volunteers. So you're kind of hopeful mm-hmm. that it will work, but it is dependent on someone else being there and providing the right information. Whereas with Aira, this is a professional service. It's, as you say, it's set up. You know, there are agents who are paid. This is their job to do this. That changes the whole notion of sort of personal assistance a little bit, doesn't it?
It does. It really is kind of our standout feature. A lot of times I like to say that our agents are the product because, you know, the technology enables our users to get connected to an agent. And obviously we're working with multiple manufacturers to have, you know, better and better hardware. So our dream is to have something that doesn't exist on the market today, which is a smart glass that would have the best camera possible, possibly multiple cameras, bone conduction audio, and cellular enabled. But the industry just isn't producing that yet today. So we're working with many manufacturers to get to that end goal. But in the meantime, what's important to our users is just simply working with the agents, and our agents are extremely talented people. We found just really, really high caliber folks, and obviously with training, really refined their skill set in providing objective information, proactive information to go above and beyond for our users. And there's so many apps today that do one or two things very well, so object recognition or reading. But what's lacking in the AI space today, which is why we really have a human in the loop model, is that the full context of a situation where you go from reading to recognizing people to describing not just objects, but, you know, the conversations that are happening around or facial expressions that are happening around us, and then getting that real time, you know, change of information based on a user's preference and request, that's where, you know, AI just isn't today. And so at Aira, we do have an AI agent that works with our agents, essentially provides our agents information, but they're able to train and refine that information. And, you know, someday the AI agent will start to do some tasks based on a user's preference, because you can imagine today there are situations in which an agent cannot help. So a public restroom, for example, we have a privacy mode feature where the user just enables that on the app, and the call is still connected, but the agent has no audio or video. But you can imagine a time where, you know, AI would just simply take over and be the agent in that restroom, or other situations where a user might prefer that.
Yeah, because, you know, if a robot sees what it sees, who cares? it doesn't matter as much, I guess. But it's fascinating because, you know, as you say, the technology isn't quite there yet, but you've managed to embed it at the moment into a pair of glasses. I mean, one of the things with a lot of this technology is it can be a little bit off-putting, let's be honest. I mean, you know, even blind people, you know, I've often said this, people who are blind, you know, still have some sense of fashion. So, you know, you might not necessarily know what the latest fashions are, but, you know, you wouldn't want to go out wearing something hideous. And Ira isn't, actually.
Absolutely.
It's quite cool looking, isn't it?
Yeah, we're definitely very fashion conscious. And again, you know, when we're able to help develop our own pair of glasses, that's something that we really want to influence. And ideally, we'd have multiple options because every user has a different sense of style and lifestyle. Some people are using Ira predominantly at the office. Some people are running the Boston Marathon with Ira, and so would need, you know, much more sturdy, sport-like pair of glasses. But we do find that our users in wearing Ira don't find it uncomfortable or find that it stands out. And so it's been a really positive experience for them in the community. And actually, the thing that our users often face more often than anything else is people, you know, just asking them about how they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, what's that thing you're wearing? Yeah.
Yeah, or mostly, you know, people will see one of our users shopping in a grocery store, finding products that they want to purchase, and they'll ask, like, oh, can I help? Because they don't understand how our user would, you know, be going about the grocery store as they please, picking out what they please. And so then the user ends up having to, you know, explain, no, I'm actually working with an Ira agent who is remotely helping me find the items that I'm requesting. And so that's actually the interaction our users have most often, is just explaining how they're doing what they're doing.
Okay, so here's a really silly question, but, you know, could you send your AI agent a picture of someone that you want to avoid, and then if the technology sees that person, you could say, hey, avoid this person, that's that person you're trying to avoid?
I'm sure that there will be a day where, yes, the AI agent could do that very same thing.
What about, perhaps more seriously and more relevant to this conversation, what about the availability of it? It's available in the States at the moment, isn't it?
It is. And so we were actually just in the UK to do a pilot with a large retailer in the country, and were able to meet with our NIB and some other great folks in town. And we really want to launch in the UK soon. So I would hope that in this next year, you know, we have the right partner to have folks on the ground. We definitely want to hire locally and for our agent pool. And we want to make the technology available. We get a lot of requests all the time internationally, UK, Asia, Australia, South America, from people that have heard about us and really, you know, want this service. And, you know, to be quite honest, the biggest thing that will hold us back is just the connectivity and making sure that we can have that 4G connectivity that, you know, live video really requires. So that's kind of our biggest challenge, but one that, you know, thankfully we're not solving on our own. The whole world is solving connectivity. And how can we be connected as fast as possible everywhere we go? So so that, you know, that will be our biggest challenge. But I think, as I said, it's solving itself.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point to make, because I think that's the first question a lot of people will ask. Well, what is the barrier? What's stopping us from getting it now? Because, you know, it must be great to work for a company, you know, that has a product that everybody just wants, and that's great. But you're right, you know, it has to be rolled out properly, because what you don't want is for a product like this to come out and it it not to work, because that
right.
comes back on you. And even though it's not your problem, it feels like, I guess, it might become your problem. So you want to get that right first. It's right. a really interesting product. A lot of people, as I say, around the world interested in it. Certainly in the UK, that's the case. How does it work in terms of pricing?
So we have three pricing plans that are available for customers to essentially choose on our website today. We have a basic plan that is $89 a month, and that's for 100 minutes. We have a plus plan, which is $129 a month, and that's for 200 minutes. And then we have the premium plan, which is $199 a month for 400 minutes. And then the first 3 months that you subscribe to Ira, we double the number of minutes just for our people to not, you know, be so conscious of how many minutes it's taking them. We want them to really feel free to explore and go nuts with Ira and find out, you know, what all they want to do with the service. We also have, you know, pricing plans for organizations or institutions like the Veterans Administration here in the States. And that's another exciting thing about the UK is you have a different payer system, if you will, for, you know, governmental benefits. And so that is another great opportunity for us as a company to really partner and understand how we can make our service subsidized by those benefits that are that already exist today. So, you know, we are doing everything that we can to make more options for more people to have IRA, and that includes how we can, you know, have IRA subsidized by the folks and the institutions that are already, you know, paying for things like sighted aids or, you know, like other technology. So we'll just have more and more options.
Yeah, no, it's a great option, and we're very excited to learn about it. I think we were all really excited when we learned you were in the UK. So that's great. That means it's coming soon, which is fantastic. Amy, good to speak to you, and best of luck with IRA.
Thank you so much, Stephen. And next time I'm there, I'll have to make it up to Scotland.
So there you go. That was IRA. And it sounds like a really great product, Shauna, a really great idea that helps us all in unique ways because, you know, you go to a shop, you're looking for something. Buying independently is very difficult when you're visually impaired.
I know. Well, just any time you just need that little bit of assistance. When I first heard about this, I was a bit dismissive because we've seen a bit of a surge in this sort of technology, I thought. But this works differently. There's not really any AI involved. It's more of just having a human assistant in your pocket at all times. It's, you know, a pair of eyes ready to go whenever you need them. There was the guy that ran the Boston Marathon with just using IRA. There were some demos I've seen where people using it in airports and railway stations. It just seems really handy. I can't wait to try this out when it comes over here.
It comes an interesting time, though. I mean, obviously, this is a specialist piece of kit. It's built for people with visual impairments, but am I right in saying that during the Worldwide Developer Conference from Apple, they were announcing some big things to do with internal beacons being used to help navigate you around things like shopping centres and airports?
Well, as part of iOS 11, there was that indoor mapping feature, which, you know, train stations and shopping malls. But I'm not sure of the technology they're going to be using for that. But there was recently a big announcement that Gatwick over here in London have just installed 2,000 iBeacons. So, you know, they obviously are being took up. I didn't think that many people were using them. I thought it was sort of a technology that no one knew about, but apparently not. We'll have to wait and see.
I'm quite excited about those. I really am. I think this idea of the beacon, you know, being able to be used, and then it means when you go into a shopping centre. I mean, that's one of the big things. I was in a shopping centre at the weekend, and I just couldn't find the shop I was looking for. And I thought, you know, and you know that way people always say, oh, it's just down there.
Yeah, that's right.
What does that mean? Just down there, what, on the left and the right? Because, of course, a lot of these shopping malls have got maybe, you know, two floors or so. So you've got quite a lot to get through. Yeah. And they say, oh, yes, just up there, and run around a bit. And, oh, yeah, okay,
it just
whatever.
Doesn't work for
and
us.
You end that. Up just going home.
Oh, I just end up jumping on their back and telling them to walk me there.
Wow, that's I want to see that. I want to see that happen. Okay, just before we go, because we're really out of time, I just wanted to mention something that we're going to be using as a bit of a demonstration. I got a chance to try out a Google Home last night, actually. I switched it on for the first time.
Jealous.
You're going to be impressed because it is a great little piece of kit. Now, I have to tell you, very similar to the Amazon Echo, right? It's very similar. It does a lot of the same things. There are small differences, like, for example, the type of music you can get from it. I mean, they've both got Spotify in them. They've both, well, that's it, actually. That's as far as it goes with the collaboration, really. Spotify, because after that, they go their own way. Amazon, of course, has its own music library, so it plays from Amazon Music, and Google Home plays from Google Play Music, if you've got an account with them. Neither of them play Apple Music, which is quite interesting. I signed up for Apple Music at the weekend, actually, and neither of them would play it. But the Amazon Echo can Bluetooth to your phone, so you can play your music that way if you want to do it. Not sure about the the Google Home and Bluetooth. I imagine it probably will, but I haven't tried it yet. I don't know. But yeah, in terms of the stuff that it can do, that I will say, if you're thinking about buying one, there are apparently there's like millions of different things you can ask it. It doesn't seem quite as ready as I thought it was going to be. I'll be honest, I was a bit disappointed. I mean, in the same way I've been disappointed in the past with the Amazon Echo. You know, I thought, oh, it's a shame it doesn't understand that. Yeah. If you don't get the command quite right on the Google Home and on Amazon Echo, it just goes, sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about. What I will say, though, is brilliant game show on it called I'm Feeling Lucky, which is hilarious. I was Sparkles. I was contestant number one, Sparkles. And my wife was Bling Bling. Yeah.
Suits you.
But yeah, it gives you names and it...
Sounds like guide dog names.
Yeah. Yeah, where's Coco? So it's brilliant for that kind of thing. It is very good, very responsive. I'd say better, far more responsive and quicker at responding than the Amazon Echo. I'll give it that.
And I thought that was really quick, so I'm surprised at that.
Yeah.
Well, I've got two questions, really, because the service on both of these can improve on their side. You know, it's not down to the hardware. It's down to what the Amazon or Google do on their side to the service. But does the Google Home sound better than the Amazon Echo?
Now, that's an interesting one. I'd say there's better bass on the Amazon Echo. Remember, or on the Google Home, I should say. The Amazon Echo, remember, and Google Home, they are pretty much just for voice interaction. So the purpose of it to be a music speaker isn't really in there. But out of the two of them, and there's not much in it, I'll say that, there's not a lot in it between them, I would say that the sound from Google Home is just a little bit better, much better bass response than on the Amazon Echo. It feels a bit more warm, the sound that comes from a Google Home, as opposed to the Amazon Echo, which feels a little bit like a cheap speaker.
Oh, okay. And my second question is the app, the Google app. Was it nice and accessible when during the sale?
It was accessible, probably arguably more accessible than any of the Amazon Echo attempts at the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, that's changed, thankfully.
Not much.
Well, it's changed a little bit, hasn't it? But it's not huge amount. I'm trying to be positive about it.
People keep telling me it's a lot better now, and I don't see any improvements myself to the Amazon Echo app. So, yeah, I'll be pessimistic about it.
Can't have it all. But yeah, the point being that you can access it. It's very good. I mean, Google are very good at that side of things.
Yeah.
So it's good, and it's a very simple thing to set up, actually. It's not as... It felt simple. I mean, it was up and running in a couple of minutes' time. Once you've signed into your Google account, it kind of works everything out from there.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of these things that once you start using it, and I will be over the next couple of weeks, I'll be interested to see how it interacts. What's funny, though, is asking it to say Alexa's name, because then Alexa talks and they have a little conversation, which is basically both of them saying, I'm sorry, I have no idea what you're talking about.
And now you've just triggered everyone who's listening their Amazon voice device. That was Stephen, not me.
Okay, Google, Alexa. There we go. Right, that's it for our show. Thank you so much for listening. We are back next week, of course, as always, same time, same place. Join us if you can. And keep those emails coming in, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Sean, until next week, thanks for listening.
Thank you.